This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1013, A Conversation with Al Milgrom. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1013. It's a conversation with Al Milgrom. Al is extremely prolific in the comic book industry, most notably as penciler and inker, also as an editor, also as a writer. So he's kind of done everything. So this was a very informative and interesting conversation. We only get up to about 1982 or 3, I believe, just in the early 80s in terms of charting out Al's career. So we have so much more to go. So there's going to be at least one, hopefully, more episode to kind of close out this career retrospective at some point in the next few months. There's a lot of episodes coming, so I have to kind of figure out where to place it, but we will be hopefully having a new conversation at some point, and then that will come out, and that'll be the natural conclusion to this episode. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, and listen to us on Spotify. I think you really enjoyed this conversation with Al. I definitely, I think I asked a couple of questions and otherwise was just along for the ride, but I thought this was a very informative and interesting look at, you know, how he started making his way in the industry and how he was navigating those early days. So thanks again for downloading this episode, and let's jump right into the conversation with Al Milgrom. Enjoy. Al, welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm glad to have you on the show. And obviously, you have this very long, exciting, I would call it exciting, running in the comic book industry. You've worn so many different hats throughout your career. But before we get into the different hats that you wore throughout that career, when did comics first become part of your life, and what were the comics you were first reading?
Well, I remember when I was quite young, first grade and maybe even earlier, not reading comics necessarily, but I used to watch the Popeye cartoons, and I loved those. And he was obviously, you know, to all intents and purposes, a superhero. I mean, once he took his spinach, he could do miraculous things. He had overwhelming super strength. He could use his pipe as either a propeller and fly, or sometimes he would blow like a jet engine. He would blow flames out of the pipe and propel himself that way. His biceps would do very unusual things. They'd either be like a hammer and an anvil, or one side would be a bowling ball and the other side would be a bunch of bowling pins. And he'd flex the bowling ball side and it would run across his shoulders and knock down the pins. Very unusual, physiology going on there. And I've actually been watching a lot of those cartoons again recently on one of the cable networks. I think it's MeTV. Mm-hmm. And I've also been watching a lot of the Time Warner stuff, the Warner Brothers stuff. And the thing that never occurred to me when I was young, of course, but the Popeye cartoons, he was Popeye the Sailor, but he did like a bunch of different jobs. He was in the Army, he was in the Navy. He ran a diner. One time, Bluto had a school where he taught etiquette, which made very little sense to me. and also Olive, who was somehow the object of both of their affections, not really an attractive girl, especially from the studio that did Betty Boop, who was kind of a weirdly sexy bobblehead looking character, but. But Olive was like a stick, and very fickle. She liked Popeye, she liked Bluto, but then Bluto would try to kiss her, and then Popeye would have to save her. At some point, I thought one or both of them would wise up, but that's only viewing it now in my adulthood, and realizing that she may not have been the ideal girlfriend for anybody, let alone Popeye or Bluto. Anyway, I used to draw Popeye. My mom had rolls of shelf lining paper. I guess the object was to keep the shelving, you know, the shelves in the kitchen cabinets relatively clean. Instead of having to clean them, you'd line them with this plain white paper, and it came in rolls, and she'd cut it to size, and then she'd lay it out. And then if it got a little, you know, grungy in there, she'd just swap out the paper and replace it. But she was good. She didn't mind if I took it and used gobs of it to draw on. And I remember I used to draw Popeye all the time, and I probably wasn't bad at it for a guy in kindergarten. I remember one time I drew a big multi-figure drawing of Popeye fighting like 20 other Popeyes. And right, and it, you know, the thing is that the rest of them were somehow imposters, but the one in the middle had some spinach dangling. I still remember this, obviously. Spinach dangling out of his mouth. So he was the one, you know, and he was laying waste to the rest of these imposters. So the spinach gave him that extra, you know, drug-induced, extra super strength that he needed to defeat even, you know, his own doppelgangers. So that was really about as close to my first, you know, visual experiences I remember. But when I don't know how I got into comic books. I don't remember. I mean, at the time, I was born in 1950, and I have some comic books still from 1957 or 58.
Oh, really?
And those were like Superman, Batman, Action Detective, you know, the superhero characters. Where I got them or how I got them, I don't, my parents would not have bought them for me. They thought comics were just terrible, and why was I wasting my time on that junk? So I guess I may have been in a drugstore and been attracted by the spinner rack and, you know, picked up a couple that looked interesting to me. And, you know, of course, at the time, if you liked superheroes or even Popeye, you know, DC was the only game in town. They had Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman. I didn't read Wonder Woman. I don't know. I guess it was misogynistic on my part, but she had no real appeal for me. But Superman and Batman I liked, and then in, you know, Action and Adventure and World's Finest and Detective, there were also backup features with different characters, you know, Green Arrow or Aquaman or Martian Manhunter or I didn't like Congo Bill as well, even when he became the what was he, the Golden Gorilla or White Gorilla, some kind of gorilla he turned into. but you know, anybody remotely superheroic seeming, I was happy to read. And that's how it started. And actually, about the time I was 10 or 12, I would say, I was sort of starting to lose interest in comics, which is not uncommon. That was sort of like the cutoff age that the companies figured they were reaching in those days. And I just, you know, I don't know if I would have been able to put an explanation or definition on it, but I, you know, looking back, it just seemed like the DC stuff was kind of dry to me. And I was friendly with a guy who lived around the block from me. And he was also into comics. And one day he came by and he says, "Hey, you want to see the worst comic you've ever seen in your life?" And I said, "Well, that sounds like a challenge. Sure." You know. And he gave me a copy of Fantastic Four number one.
Oh, wow.
Right? And he gave it to me, and he didn't want it back. He thought it was just the worst thing he'd ever read. And reading it, I have to say that I kind of agreed with him. I just thought it was terrible. And the reason I thought it was terrible was, you know, the FF, I mean, from the very start, the, you know, the splash page, they're running around, the Thing is in a store with, you know, with his overcoat and his hat pulled low, and he sees the Fantastic Four, you know, Reed Richards shot the flare into the sky, summoning the rest of them. And so he goes tearing out the door without thinking, rips the doors right out of the frame, and the frame too. and just, you know, left the front of the storefront in shambles. Sue runs down the street, half invisible, and I think she's half in clothes, but she's knocking people out of her way. You know, she was in a big hurry. And the torch is flying towards the Baxter Building, and Air Force jets that have been scrambled to intercept them melt. And, you know, as an upright citizen, big DC fan of, you know, of what's upright and moral, I was outraged by the way they mistreated the public and public property and all that stuff. I mean, it rubbed me the wrong way. It really did. So, and Marvel in those days had very, you know, they were just getting back into the superhero stuff. They had very spotty distribution. And I find out, you know, that, you know, I the next issue I saw, not that I was really looking for it, but, you know, the next one I saw on the newsstands was number 3 of the Fantastic Four. And that was the one that had them get their costumes, you know, sewed them all costumes.
Mm-hmm.
She gave the Thing a nice helmet so you wouldn't have to look at his ugly pan. And they had a supervillain of sorts, was it the Miracle Man or somebody? I don't remember his name, but he was a mass hypnotist. He had super hypnotic powers. So he could convince people that, you know, there were these giant monsters laying waste to the city. But it was all an illusion, so nothing bad really happened. But it caused a lot of panic and, you know, probably people running each other over in the streets trying to escape these imaginary monsters. And they got the first Fantastic Car, which looked, you know, as Stan, I think, put it, looked like a flying bathtub. You know, but I thought, you know, this isn't really bad. This is kind of cool. What's going on in this? And I think part of the issue there with Stan and Jack, they had been doing the Monster Book anthologies, you know, Tales to Astonish and Strange Tales, Journey into Mystery, Tales of Suspense, the whole batch. And what happened was they were still sort of locked into that monster mentality. So, like, you know, the first Fantastic Four, you know, they fought the Mole Man and his whole horde of underground creatures, including at least one super giant guy, you know. And then the second one, they fought the Skrulls, I believe it was. And, you know, and they were kind of, they looked like monsters. They were outer space monsters, but still monsters. And then the third one, of course, they introduced the, you know, Miracle Man. And, you know, and then the next one I saw was number 6. I kept missing 2 issues in a row. Because, again, body distribution.
Yeah.
Number 6 literally changed my life because I got it. I saw it on the newsstands. I leafed through it. I said, oh, who's this guy? Dr. Doom? And who's this guy? Submariner? Because I thought that's how you should pronounce it, because I find out later it's Submariner. So more like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner than the atomic submarines. Mm. Anyway, so all of a sudden, you know, I said, well, I got to buy this, and I bought it, and I took it home, and I read it, and I was not aware of, you know, Stan Lee, I was not aware of Jack Kirby, but man, there was the sequence where, you know, Doom and Subby team up. They attach like a tin can to the bottom of the Baxter Building, which is a super magnet, and Doom, you know, takes off and flies into outer space, carrying the Baxter Building with him, you know, and you go, oh my God. And the air is starting to get thin, and they, you know, Reed tries to stretch out and reach Doom's ship, which is ahead of them, but he can't. The harsh outer space conditions are too much for him, and the torch jumps out the window to try and go after him, but lack of oxygen, and he flames out. And Reed catches him, of course, and hauls him back in. The Thing's, you know, he's going, ah, my strength is useless, but I, you know, but by this time, you know, Submariner's on, you know, in the Baxter Building. He was like a decoy while Doom engineered this whole stealing the whole building business. And they realize that Submariner's in on the plot. And so the Thing says, yeah, at least I can still, you know, beat the crap out of you, buddy. And he's about to do that. And Submariner says, you know, wait a minute, let's team up here. He, you know, he backstab me as well. So there's sort of nothing they can do. So Reed says, well, here, I have this giant vat of water. Jump in there to replenish your strength, which he does. And then I think they gave Subby some kind of an air helmet, but it's filled with water, so he can have water to breathe while he's, you know, going after the craft. And he jumps out the window of the Baxter Building, and he latches onto this. There's this meteor shower that just happens to be going by at the time. And he goes from one meteor to the other, leaping from one to the next, getting closer and closer to Doom's ship. And I'll remember this as long as I live, unless I, you know, become non-compos mentis. There's a three-panel sequence where he's yelling. It's in, like, very, you know, tight foreshortening on his figure, arms outstretched as he leaps from one meteor to the next. And each panel, you're closer and closer to the figure of the Submariner. And he's going, go, 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 and, you know, in bigger, you know, bolder lettering each time. And the perspective was like something I'd never, you know, Kurt Swan never drew anything in perspective like this in his life on Superman. Terrific artist, Kurt Swan, very competent, very solid. But man, Jack Kirby, he would do those exaggerations like nobody else. And then he gets to Doom's ship and he smashes his way inside the ship. You know, and then he confronts Doom, and, you know, I don't remember. I think Doom probably jumped out the porthole and had, like, jetpack. So, you know, Doom always prepared for any eventuality, of course. But, after that, I was running around. I would go. There were three drugstores within bike riding distance of my house. And I was looking for that next issue of the Fantastic Four everywhere I could. I mean, it was I don't remember which one was number 7. Was that the one with the people from that planet that was going extinct, and they had the, is that the one where Reed shrank them all?
I can't remember.
Yeah, and then there was the, you know, the puppet master with Alicia gets introduced. Anyway, but the main thing, I'm going, like, you know, in number 6, they're going, like, you know, there's footnotes. Submariner introduced in Fantastic Four number 4, you know, Dr. Doom introduced in Fantastic Four number 5, and I'm going, like, I gotta find these comic books, you know. And I remember at the time, like, hunting high and low, and I got a copy of number 4, a ratty, beat up looking copy, which I still have, from some kid that I knew at Hebrew school, and he sold it to me for, I think it was 50 cents. And although part of me was outraged at the extremely high price, because the books were 10 cents in those days, I had to have it. I had to get it, and I did. And then, by a lucky miracle, I found the number 5 with Dr. Doom, inked, incidentally, by Joe Sinnott. And I remember thinking that the artwork looked especially good in that one at the time. But I found it in a mom-and-pop shop, where they, in a neighborhood store, again, within bike riding distance of my house. And this place used to sell, like, comics with the title logo of the cover cut off.
Oh, okay.
And years later, I came to realize that, you know, the local distributors, the local drugstores, or somebody was, you know, was selling these. They were supposed to be destroyed. People were getting credit for non-sales, you know, like the local store, you know, the distributors would get the books, they'd put them in all the local shops that carried them. So if they gave, Lincoln Drugs 100 copies of something, and then Lincoln Drugs sold 40 copies, they'd give them the other 60 copies back and get full credit, you know, and they'd only get charged for the, you know, they'd only have to pay for the 40 they actually used and sold and made a profit on. So I think what they were doing is the distributor was taking the 60 copies that were returned and getting credit from the publisher, and the, you know, and then they would sell them for 2 cents each to local mom and pop stores, you know. But in those days they still had to return the the part of the, at one point they used to return the books, and then they went to returning. They would just tear off the covers, and you'd find coverless ones in places. And then that was too much for them, so they just slit, you know, the top off with the logo and return those for credit. And then at some point, they actually went to the honor system. And man, oh man, the distributors took full advantage. Oh, the honor system. We have no honor. We will now just claim whatever seems reasonable that we can get away with and get credit for all the ones. And, you know, so they're making money, you know, distributing the copies to the drugstores that sell them. But they're also, you know, getting credit for the ones that aren't sold, but yet they're taking those and selling them for a little bit of money. You know, the mom and pop store, where I found FF number 5, sold them for a nickel. And most of them had the, like I said, the logo cut off. But in this case, they had 2 copies of FF number 5 in perfect condition, logos intact. I bought them both. And you know, and then it was just a matter of, like, hunting down Marvel Comics wherever I could find them, because half the time they wouldn't show up at my local drugstores. Mm. In fact, I ended up getting a subscription to the Fantastic Four because I thought I missed the one where, it was number 11 or 12 or 10, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was 11, where the Hulk guest starred. So here was like one of their first big crossover things, and I went, oh my God, I thought I missed it. I wrote off to Marvel, sent him my money for a subscription. I said, please start it with this issue, because I missed this issue on the newsstands. Of course, the first one I ever got from them was number 16, which had the Ant-Man. That was kind of cool, too. But the bottom line is that, you know, they couldn't really give me the one that I wanted, although I did ultimately find that on the newsstand a couple weeks later. So I guess, you know, I knew when it was supposed to come out, but apparently the distributors didn't. So anyway, but then I was sucked back into the hobby real hard and, you know, full blown, and ended up, you know, getting, you know, so into it that I continued my drawing of those characters instead of Popeye, and followed the stuff from then on. As it happens, in middle school, I met Jim Starlin. We went to the same school. And, you know, somebody said, oh, you draw comics? Oh, we got a friend who draws comics. And they introduced me to Jim. And I went, oh, my God, this guy is so much better than I am. Maybe I'll just ink his stuff. And I did. So for several years there, I would still draw. I mean, I would draw stuff. I'd do a page or a panel or a figure drawing or something like that. While I'm doing that, Jim's batting out 20-page stories, you know, left and right. I mean, he just had the creativity to do that stuff, and you know, it was like bursting out of it really was, you know, and again, you know, better than what I was doing. So I said, okay, I'm riding this guy's coattails to the big time, and I did. You know, we went to high school together also, and I was aware of fanzines at the time, and I introduced Jim to those, and he submitted some samples, and you know, they weren't idiots. They, you know, he started working for this group called the Texas Trio in Texas, obviously. They published a bunch of different superheroes in, you know, fanzine form, color covers, black and white interiors. Jim was doing a lot of stuff for them. So, you know, that was my earliest days in the industry. And ultimately what happened was Jim, we both graduated high school. He went into the Navy. I went into college. He mustered out of the Navy. I graduated college. And in the summer of 1972, he'd been actually out in New York already for a few months. And, you know, he was starting to get some work up at Marvel. And I came out with my samples and, you know, showed him around and got a lot of, well, kid, you're not there yet, but you show promise, you know. And I ended up getting a job working as a background man for Murphy Anderson up at D.C. And Murphy was a, you know, terrific old-time pro. He'd been around since the 40s. Seemed like an old man to me. He was probably in his 40s at the time. I think probably his early 40s. A terrific artist. A sweet, sweet gentleman of a guy, embarrassed as hell to be doing comics for a living, which is funny, I mean, because he had a long career. He did the Buck Rogers newspaper strip and everything. But, you know, one time he said, Alan, do you read those, like, on your commute home? And I said, yeah, oh, sure, all the time, Murph. And he said, oh, I would never, like, read them in public, you know. I said, I said, but Murphy, you love comics and you're really good at drawing comics. Why would that, why should you be embarrassed? Oh, no, no, no. It's just, it's not, it's like not a fit profession for an adult kind of a thing. And it, and it's funny because he used to work at the DC offices. He'd come in, like he'd commute, he lived in Jersey. He'd come in every day. He'd commute in on a train. He wore a suit and tie. He had an attaché case. And when he opened up the attaché case, it had brushes and pens and ink and pages, you know, that he was working on. And it was just like a little mini art studio in there. But he wanted to make it look like he was some sort of businessman, I guess. So it just cracked me up. But, you know, but he was a very good and patient teacher and helped me learn a lot of stuff. And one thing I think he did was I, when you're a kid, you got guy. I loved Kirby stuff, and although I respected Murphy's stuff, his stuff was very quiet. For what the stuff that appealed to me was Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, and then the Marvel guys who were all at the time sort of more or less doing their best to sort of channel Jack Kirby. Mm-hmm. And these were guys, you know, I mean Ditko not at all, but he had his own very distinctive and strong style. But Don Heck and Dick Ayers were both sort of, seemed to me to be second-tier Jack Kirby's, while which is, you know, again, a lack of knowledge. I mean, both of them had been very prolific and respected artists. You know, Don drew Westerns and mystery and hard-bitten detective stuff all through the 50s. He was one of the top cover artists for... probably was Harvey Comics on their serious stuff. Mm. Dick was, he was very good at Westerns and horror stuff. He worked for, you know, Stan on all of the horror titles during the 50s when the superheroes were, you know, were sort of in a state of suspended animation. I was just a snot-nosed punk kid, and they're no good. Jack Kirby, you know. Well, there's only one Jack Kirby. You know, and even the other Marvel artists who were, you know, certainly shepherded by Stan to try to make their stuff more dramatic as Kirby's was, they weren't Jack Kirby either. But I liked them, and I was happy to, you know, when Jack couldn't draw everything anymore, you know. Because even Jack, how many books could he do a month? But, you know, they were fine substitutes on the Avengers, and of course nobody could draw Spider-Man like Ditko, and of course when he introduced Doctor Strange, same deal there. Other fine artists did good jobs on those characters, but you know, Steve was, man, he was a hard act to follow. And even when Romita took over the Spider-Man strip from him, I remember liking the early Romita issues quite a bit. And when I met him years later and talked to him about it, you know, he said, you know, he was purposely trying to mimic Ditko. And if you look at it, his approach to the character and the way he inked it in particular was very much influenced by Ditko. And I hadn't quite realized it at the time. And John, you know, being an old-timer, says, yeah, I didn't want it to be too, you know, jarring a change when I took over the art. So I tried to keep it in the Ditko style for a while, and then gradually, you know, made it more and more my own approach. Mm-hmm. And I now, you know, when he said that, I said, my God, that is exactly what you did, you know. And he did a great job of it. And he did, you know, in fact, I probably, in some ways, like the stuff he did when he was mimicking Ditko somewhat to his own style. But that's just, that's just my youthful take on it. John was a terrific cartoonist. And did great looking girls, certainly far better looking girls than Ditko ever did. And, he was a terrific artist. And, you know, at DC, he was, you know, I don't want to say wasted, but he's doing romance stories. And I think at some time in the earlier 50s, he had been doing Westerns and stuff like that because the superhero was falling out of prominence. But for somebody of his talent, I mean, I thought the funny thing about DC was they had guys who were, you know, like Romita and like Gene Colan and even Ross Andrew to a certain extent, who were, you know, they weren't thought of as the top tier artists, and yet they went over to Marvel and they became superstars. And part of it, I think, was you know, the way Stan encouraged them to, you know, stretch their artistic muscles and probably mimic Kirby. And sometimes, you know, he'd have Kirby, like, do layouts for an issue to get them into the storytelling sense of it. You know, I remember there was an early issue, I think, of Daredevil that Romita drew, and it was clear that there was something slightly more dynamic going on there, and I think that's because Kirby did the layouts for it. Mm-hmm. And Gene Colan, I thought, well, the big problem with Gene was they had him do Submariner, and they had him inked by Vinnie Coletta. And for a guy like Colan, who does really nice, juicy blacks and uses a lot of photo reference for backgrounds and so on, and Vinnie had that wispy pen line approach. Not that he couldn't do good brushwork, but he just, I think he felt like editors would think he was doing more and harder work if you put in a lot of pen lines, even if they didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. And that's the way, I thought his work on early Colan was wispy and it just looked puny to me. It just did not look, I don't know, it had no, what's the word I'm looking for?
Gravitas? Or?
Gravitas, exactly the word I was looking for. Thank you, yes. But then, you know, they started getting Gene inked by other people, and suddenly his stuff looked a lot better, and everybody who came over from DC went from either doing tepid romance-looking stuff to really great, dynamic, Marvel-type stuff. And, you know, Stan, whatever else you may want to say about him, he really knew how to herd a bunch of, you know, cats or artists, you know, depending on your point of view, you know, and make them better and make them more dramatic and let them break loose with their storytelling a little bit more than they ever had. Of course, they went from working, you know, full script over at DC, where the writers had very tight control over it, to Marvel style, where Stan couldn't keep up with everything. And in order to facilitate the work getting done, and also everybody having work when they needed it, work, you know, developed that sort of Marvel style. I'm not sure if he was the first or the only guy to have done it prior to that, but it was really effective for him, and you know, it made these guys, they had to challenge themselves a little more, and I don't know how tight the plotting was that Stan did, but I'm sure they had to flesh out a lot of the elements of the story, and these guys had all been in comics for many years and did a great job of it. So anyway, that was an awful long-winded thing, considering you just asked me how I got my start. But now ask me another question. I'll go on for another half an hour.
Okay. Well, I do have a question about, you know, it seems that once you kind of start breaking in, it seems like you did a lot of inks specifically on covers for the first, you know, decade, before you kind of transitioned. I mean, you were still doing some interiors here and there, but it felt like you were doing a lot of inks over, you know, covers in particular. Do you think there's any particular reason as to why that happened, or was it just kind of luck of the draw?
I don't think that's true, because, you know, covers were the big thing. They wanted the covers to look really good.
Mm-hmm.
As a beginner, I was pretty good at inking Starlin, but I hadn't inked a lot of anybody else. And I don't recall doing a lot of covers, but what I did do, you know, Starlin, you know, became the penciler on Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept getting different inkers, and he wanted more consistency. He had, Dave Cockrum inked one issue. Of course, that was pretty good. And I think Mike Esposito inked an issue, and that was okay. And I feel like Pablo Marcos inked one of his early ones.
Oh, really?
And who else? I don't remember. But what happened was I inked the job of Jim's. He did a backup story for DC. I was still working for Murphy at the time. I worked for Murphy for almost exactly 1 year, from the summer of 72 to the summer of 73. And what happened was Murphy was leaving comics to go work. He had done a PS magazine with Will Eisner, the Army Preventive Services monthly magazine, and what it was a it was a visual pictorial handbook for how to service all the military equipment, guns, tanks, jeeps, whatever there was. And Eisner, you know, was, of course, an excellent illustrator, and he got the contract and did it for several years for the Army. And he had decided to, I don't know if it was not paying well enough for him or what, but he decided to quit. And Murphy had worked for him at PS Magazine. And so Murphy put in a bid to be the packager for the Army. And he won. So he was going to leave comics and produce this magazine, asked if I wanted to, you know, work for him and come with him, as it were. But I said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to draw comic books. And he understood. And right around that time, Jim asked if I could ink this backup story for Sword of Sorcery. It was the characters, Fritz Leiber's Fafford and the Grey Mouser. Mm-hmm. And this was the Grey Mouser single, you know, character backup story. And I inked it, and Jim was an incredibly tight penciler, so you couldn't go wrong with his stuff. And I did a very nice job, if I say so myself. And people, I was still working up at DC, and people would come up, and I'd say, hey, what are you working on? I'd show them, and they'd go, oh, that looks really good, Al, blah, blah. And Dave Cockrum saw it, and he said, Al, that looks really good. Can you ink 4 pages of Superboy and the Legion for me? I said, sure. And he said, only don't ink the heads, don't ink the faces. I said, okay. So I inked everything but the faces on 4 pages of that. And at that same time, Simonson had just recently broken into the business. And as it turns out, he was doing the lead feature in Sword of Sorcery, that issue, which was Fafford and the Grey Mouser together. And Walt was always up against the deadline. And he said, hey, I like what you did on that Starlin job. Would you be interested in, you know, coming out to my apartment in Brooklyn? I laid out as it turns out, it was the lead feature for that same issue. He says, I laid out the lead feature, but it's due in like about a week, and I got to tighten up the pages. And I thought I could, as I tighten them up, I could hand them over to you and you could ink them. And I said, you know, I was willing to do anything in those days, you know. And I said, sure, you know. So I brought a change of clothes or two. And I took, I don't even know how, I must have taken a subway out to Brooklyn somehow. I have no recollection. And I, you know, showed up at his apartment, and he had a spare board. And, we, you know, I sat down. He's tightening up pages. He's handing them over. I'm inking pages. I'm handing him back. He's saying, that looks great, you know. And it's weird because I was, you know, fresh off a year of doing backgrounds for Murphy Anderson, and I was trying my best to ink like Murphy Anderson. And so, you know, Walt Simonson does not draw remotely like Murphy Anderson, or almost anybody else for that matter. Mm. But, you know, but it was I did a competent job, and he was happy enough that it was just getting done, you know. And at the end of the week, I remember I was traveling home to Michigan for a visit, and we got the story done, and he said, thanks a lot. I don't remember if he paid me or if DC paid me, but, you know, somebody got me paid. And he said, and we had a great time. I mean, I think Walter's a terrific guy. Everybody does. And we had a terrific time spending the week together. You know, I mean, we were there. It was very intense. We're living together. We're going out for meals together. He's penciling. I'm inking. Blah, blah, blah. Talking, telling tales, you know, so on and so forth. Anyway, I said, hey, you know, my roommate, who at the time was Elliot Magan, the writer of Superman.
Oh, wow.
What's that?
I said, oh, wow. Like, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Elliot and I got friendly, you know, meeting up at the D.C. offices. So I said, my roommate just moved out to move in with a girlfriend. So, I've got this 2-bedroom apartment, and, you know, one of the bedrooms is now empty. And I said, you know, I really had a good time this week. If you're interested in having a roommate, you know, the offer's there. And Walt said, yeah, that might be fun, you know. And so I went home to Michigan and visited for a while. And, you know, when I got back, he said, you know, yeah, I'm going to take you. My lease is almost up on my apartment here. And if the offer's still open, you know, I'll move in with you. I said, great. And at the same time, Murphy was leaving to do PS Magazine. In fact, I actually, he gave me pages of some Superman job to do backgrounds on, and I actually had to turn some of them back unfinished because that rapid succession of doing the Starlin job, helping Cockrum, and then working with Walter, and then going home for a trip, I just couldn't get the stuff done. And I said, Murphy, I'm really sorry to let you down. He said, no, that's okay. I understand you got a lot going on. And when I came back from Michigan, Starlin said, look, come on over to Marvel. I want to talk to you about something. I said, okay, sure. So I popped over there. And he said, look, I'm doing Captain Marvel now, and I'd really like to have a regular, consistent anchor on it. Would you be interested? I said, are you kidding? Of course. this is what I've been training all through middle school and high school, is to ink your stuff. So I remember this is very funny, because Marvel, DC was a very tight-knit, uptight organization, very corporate.
Mm-hmm.
We walk into Marvel. We walk into John Verporten's office. Verporten was the production manager. He used to say, a big, heavy-set guy. He had glasses. They were always about halfway down his nose. So always smoking a pipe and always proofreading, books that, he was responsible, because it was the one-editor system up there at the time. There was only one editor for the whole line. So he would be the proofreader as well as production manager. And I walk in with Starlin. Jim says, John, this is Al Milgram. Al, this is John Verporten. I said, hey, John, nice to meet you. He goes, he nods, grunts. he says, John, he says, Al's going to be inking Captain Marvel from now on. And John looked over at me, and he just shrugged. he went, what can I do about it? it was just like, I didn't have to talk to Roy Thomas. I didn't have to go through channel. He just said, okay, it's a fait accompli. So, and that's when I started inking him, and, but I don't remember inking a lot of covers. In fact, my first year or so in the business, I probably inked very, very few covers. Starlin's, yes, and that would have been on, probably Captain Marvel and, what else was I doing? Oh, well, when we started doing Master of Kung Fu, I did those covers. But I don't remember inking too many other people. I think you're misremembering it.
Well, that's possible.
Honestly.
I had looked at a listing of a lot of the work you'd done in the 70s, and it felt like, looking at it, that there was a lot of covers. But I could be wrong. I could be mistaken.
Well, maybe a little later in the 70s. I mean, for one thing, I was always happy to take on more work than I could handle. Besides the Starlin stuff, he did Captain Marvel. Then when he quit Captain Marvel, they said, well, Milgram draws sort of like Starlin. Let's get him on it. Because I had taken samples in to show Roy Thomas one time. And it was funny because he was on the phone. And Roy is a talker. Roy will talk both your ears off. And he was on the phone. And I'm sitting there with, I think, two or three pages of Master of Kung Fu samples that I had done, and I'm waiting to see him, and Starlin happened to come by, and he looked at me and said, what are you waiting for? I said, I'm waiting to show Roy these pencils I did. And so he takes them from my hand, he walks into Roy's office, he flops them down on Roy's desk, and he walks out. And Roy, now temporarily distracted from his phone call, looks at the pages, and he goes, whose are these? And I'm still outside the door, and I leaned in from around the door frame, and I waved, and I said, those are mine, Roy. And he said, yeah, these look pretty good. And I said, oh, well, thanks. And he says, yeah, I'll talk to you about these later. And he went back to his conversation. But, that's when I started getting, work. I followed Jim on Captain Marvel. I followed him on Master of Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm.
I got Guardians all on my own, so I was drawing the Guardians covers. I was inking the Captain Marvel and Kung Fu covers, and then when I took those books over, I was drawing those covers and inking them. And sometimes, I pencil them, and other people would ink them.
Hmm.
But then, all through the mid to late 70s, I was in a lot. I was available, especially for covers, because they were always desperate to get the covers done, because they're trying to promote the books. And they're wanting, they need the cover, the covers ahead of time, so they can, do publicity for upcoming stuff. And so I was available, and I, you know, I inked, well, I inked, you know, some Gil Kane. I always found him very difficult. His stuff looks so, you know, beautifully drawn, beautifully composed, you know, a good storyteller. I mean, his design was fantastic. But I always felt, as many people have pointed out in the past, that his stuff looked like mannequins. They didn't look like human beings. And I found it difficult to try to flesh it out. And I probably should have just stuck with what was there in the pencils and just, you know, figured out how to add some blacks or something. But I kept trying to render them, and that was not a good decision. But I, there were a handful I did over him that I was pretty happy with, and, you know, some others less so. But I did ink a number of his covers, and I inked a handful of a very few John Buscema covers. And, you know, whoever else was around, I don't even remember. I inked some Ron Wilson covers. I penciled a number of covers that either I or other people would ink. You know, the advantage of me penciling my own covers is that I could ink them if the editors so desired. So that, you know, that saved having to farm them out for like another day or two before somebody could ink them and bring them back into the office. So, you know, I guess I had my, utilitarian uses that way, certainly. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I became pretty prolific. I had two things going for me. When I became an editor at well, I was doing a lot of covers for Marvel, and one of the, I inked a number of Kirby covers for Marvel, but that was because Jerry Conway, when he was editor, which was only for about a month at Marvel, he liked my cover designs, and he said, "Al, you know, Kirby's back at Marvel now, and we want him to do a lot of the covers like he used to in the old days." And, you know, it's Jack Kirby, so, you know, he's the greatest comic book artist who ever lived. So, you know, but we want you to do cover sketches for him. And I said, but it's Jack Kirby, you know, he doesn't need somebody to do sketches for him. He said, no, he doesn't, but he's living in California. And that means we have to ship out, you know, 22 pages of photocopies of every issue we want him to do the cover on. And then he'd have to take his time and go through that and find a cover scene. And then he'd have to send in a sketch for approval. And so he says it would cost him a lot of money, cost us money, and we'd have to, you know, FedEx the stuff out there because, you know, everything's so late and urgent, you know, and then we'd be sending out hundreds and hundreds of pages of Xeroxes. And then he'd be wasting his time going through all these Xeroxes to find it. So you do the grunt work. You go through the, you know, copies and do a sketch and, you know, do them for Jack. And then, you know, he'd pencil them and then we got Kirby covers and it saves us some time and money. I said, Jerry, I'm very flattered. I'd love to do it. I said, but I have one condition. He says, what's that? I said, I want to ink the covers that I do the cover sketches for over Jack's stuff. He said, yeah, we got no problem with that. You know, we like your inking. So I started doing those. And I went up to Continuity one time and showed these cover sketches to Neil Adams. And he thought they were pretty good. And Neil was not a big fan of my stuff because I didn't draw remotely well enough to impress him or anything like him at all. So, but I think he saw that the designs were strong. And at the time, he was seeing or dating or having business relations with Jeanette Kahn. And I guess he either showed her some of these cover sketches I'd done or told her about them and said, hey, you know who's doing really good covers? It's this Al Milgram over at Marvel Comics. And so the next thing I know, Joe Orlando calls me and he says, hey, Al, you want to come over? I got something I want to discuss. So I go over. And he says, look, Jeanette saw these covers that you did for Marvel, and she really likes them. And she wants you to do covers for us. So I'm, you know, I'm all flattered, you know, and I'm going, wow, you know, they want me to do covers for DC. So I'm thinking, okay, I'll do covers for DC and Marvel. Why not? And Joe says to me, he says, yeah, so, you know, we want you to do covers. He said, but, you know, one thing, he says, we don't want them to look like those Marvel covers. And I went, well, I don't understand. You said she liked my Marvel. Yeah, she liked the design of the covers, but we don't want them to look like they're Marvel covers. And I said, okay, Joe. And I proceeded to do a bunch of covers for DC. I worked on The Karate Kid and The Legion of Superheroes and Superboy. And, you know, I did a couple Western covers. I did a couple war book covers, you know, which were not my forte. But I did them nonetheless. And, you know, and I did my darndest to make them. I tried to draw better. I tried to draw more draftsman-like, you know. So maybe I tried to, you know, channel Neil a little bit, but, you know, I can't draw like Neil. And although I tried. When I brought samples out to New York in the first place, I did some Marvel-style stuff and some DC-style stuff. And for the DC stuff, I tried to make it look like Neil. And Neil noted that, and I showed him my portfolio one time, and he says, "Oh, this looks like me a little bit." I said, "Yeah, that's what I was trying for." Anyway, so you know, and I'm you know thinking Murphy Anderson, and I'm thinking Carmine Infant, you know, so I'm thinking all the DC guys, many of whom I liked quite a bit, their art, and I'm doing them, and then I get called into the office from Joe Orlando, and he says, "Al, you know, listen, I heard from Jeanette. And she's really not happy with those covers you're doing." I said, "Why is that, Joe?" And he kind of sheepishly looked at me and he says, "Well, she said they don't like look like your Marvel covers." And I said, "Joe, you told me not to draw them to look like the Marvel covers." And he didn't tell her that. He just threw me under the bus. He probably said, "Oh, I don't know what happened. I don't know why. He's probably just trying to do something he thinks we..." You know, but he never said I told him to work that way, because then he would have gotten in trouble. So I was really pissed off at him. But and then I proceeded to try to do stuff, you know, more like my own Marvel-esque looking style. So that was a weird little story about Joe Orlando and, you know, giving me bad advice. But anyway, you know, so
I do have a question about this period. So, I mean, when you're at back at DC and you end up being an editor there as well, and then I guess you leave after the implosion, what was that like for you at the time? And I guess you were working on Firestorm previous to the implosion as well, co-creating it with Jerry Conway.
Yes, well, Jerry, you know, came up with the whole concept. I did all the designs, of course. And what happened was I was doing covers for Marvel. I was doing covers for DC. Archie Goodwin, by this time, had become editor-in-chief at Marvel. And he came up to me and says, I was still, you know, freelancing at the time. And he says, "Al, how come you're doing these covers for DC?" And I said, "Well, you know, look, Archie, you know how it is. I'm a fan of the Marvel stuff, but I'm also a fan of the DC stuff. And, you know, they asked me if I would do covers for them. And, of course, I was flattered. And, you know, and I said, and, you know, they actually pay me a better rate on the covers than you guys do." And he said, "Well, if the money means that much to you," and he kind of stormed out of my presence over there. And I thought about it, and I went in to talk to him. I said, "Look, Arch, I understand, you know, you're editor-in-chief here now, and so, of course, it means something to you, you know, look, I love working for Marvel. Really, the Marvel books are my favorite books. And if it's going to be a conflict, I envision my Marvel work drying up, you know. And I was, at the time, all I was doing for DC was covers. So I didn't want to lose my Marvel overwhelmingly greater amount of work for a handful of covers at DC." And he said, "No," I appreciate that. He says, "But you're right. You know, you're a freelancer. You should do the work that pays you best. And, you know, there, as far as I'm concerned, there's no repercussions, you know, on our end." And I said, "You know, you're a gentleman and a scholar, and I appreciate that, because, you know, we were friendly, and I didn't want there to be any hard feelings." Shortly after that, however, I think Neil must have, I think probably Jeanette complained to Neil about my bad covers that I was doing for him. And Neil, trying desperately to keep me out of the drawing business, said, "You know, he'd probably make a really good editor, because he has a college education And, you know, I spoke, I suppose, well enough. You know, I was well-spoken. You know, and, you know, he might be a good editor up here. And they were looking to expand and get some more editors. So they hired me, and they hired Larry. You know, Jeanette offered me an editorial job. And what happened was I was sort of, you know, I was such a comic book guy. I said, oh, I think it'd be really interesting to take on an editorial job and see what that's like. What's, you know, what's life like on the other side of that desk? And so I accepted the offer, and then I went to work for DC. And Jerry and I, as you said, created Firestorm. And it was, yes, in the middle of what was being billed as the DC Explosion. And Firestorm was one of the many new characters they were introducing, and they were also going to add to the page count of the books. They decided instead of having to raise the price 2 cents or a nickel, you know, every so often, they were going to, like, add in, like, the books were 32 pages long. That's two signatures. The signature was 16 pages. Mm. That has to do with how the paper is folded and trimmed at the printing plant. And so they decided to boldly add another half signature, which was 8 pages. And that was a little problematic because it was more expensive to add 8 pages proportionately than it would have been to add a whole nother signature, like another 16 pages. But they were too, you know, too chicken shit to do a whole other signature. They did add the 8 pages, and they introduced a whole bunch of new backup characters and features and new, new titles and everything else. And just as it was getting off the ground, they got sales figures, and they weren't good. And this was not on any of the DC Explosion stuff. That would have been too early for them to have results yet. But the previous 6 months or a year's worth of sales figures were not promising, and they decided this is no time to be expanding in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, word came down from corporate that they had to not only cut back to the regular size books, but and cut all the new titles and cut, you know, all the backup features, but also they had to fire 40% of the staff. So, you know, they did the usual kind of last in, first out situation. They fired me. They fired Larry Hama. They said, you know, we thought you guys were doing good work, but, you know, there's some other guys up here who have families, and you two are both single. So, they made it sound like there was some sort of corporate benevolence going on, and maybe there was, you know. So I said, okay, fine, you know, and I immediately called Marvel. Oh, Jeanette came by, personally and apologized for having to let me go and said, but you have priority for freelance work and, you know, we'll keep you guys busy and don't worry. Well, I never got a single offer from DC for any work. And so I, you know, called Marvel and I said, hey, I'm looking for work. And that same day, Archie Goodwin called me up and he said, look, Al, come on over. I got how would you like to ink an issue of Star Wars over Herb Trimpe? And I said, great. I love Herb stuff. And I popped over, picked up 4 pages to start and did that, you know. And but, Archie was in, maybe was he writing the title at the time? But he wasn't, I don't think he was still the editor-in-chief. By this time, he had been editor-in-chief. Hated the job, went back to, editing and writing, and Shooter was in charge. And within a very short time, Jim called me up, and he said, Al, can you come over? I'd like to talk to you. I think we have something for you. And I thought he was talking about some other freelance stuff to work on. Because I was young enough and stupid enough not to feel threatened by the lack of a job. I just figured, okay, I'm back to freelancing. Great. You know, I liked it. I just wanted to see what being an editor was like. But no, lo and behold, when I got there, he said, look, Al, Marvel, this is insanity. Marvel's running late on almost all their books. We're doing reprints. We're doing fill-ins. And since there's not people around to handle the fill-ins, there were more reprints than fill-ins. And we're paying late fees at the engravers and late fees at the printers, and it's killing us. And I convinced corporate that, you know, or Cadence or whoever it was at the time, that we had to have an editorial staff. That one man cannot, when it was just Dan or just Roy, it was manageable and barely manageable. And now it's not manageable. And he said, I convinced them that they needed an editorial staff. And I said, well, you must be some kind of miracle worker because, you know, suddenly you're talking about hiring, what, 3, 4, 5 editors? And that's going to be salaries and fringe benefits for, you know, for like all those people. And he said, yeah, they said we've never had that. And how are we going to, the extra expense, it's you know, inconceivable. And he said, how much are you paying in late fees right now? And they said, oh, that's a lot higher than inconceivable. So they went ahead and let him have his free reign for that. So he hired me, and after a short period of time, he hired Larry, and then he hired Louise Simonson, and I think he had hired Salicrop. I don't know when exactly Grunewald came in there, but he basically put together an editorial staff. And he brilliantly, I thought, he said, let's get promising newcomers, let's get old pros, maybe some who aren't getting much, if any, work these days, and let's get a whole shit ton of, you know, of fill-in issues done. Mm-hmm. And he said, and one of the smart things he did was, let's have a fill-in issue with Captain America and Spider-Man and, you know, Ghost Rider. I don't know. So then, if there was an issue of Spider-Man running late, you could use it as an issue of Spider-Man. If there was a Captain America issue running late, you could use it as Cap. Ghost Rider. Or you could make it an issue of the Avengers if you wanted to stretch things. Or you could make it a team-up or a two-in-one, you know, one of those crossover titles. And so that's what he did. And, guys were flocking in, you know, borderline guys who weren't really good enough to be getting work yet, but were going to get there eventually, or with the benefit of a decent anchor could pass for professional. And he put together a whole bunch of these books coming in, and slowly but surely, over a course of a period of time, there were no more of those reprint issues. He would use these fill-ins, you know, that he carefully planned for. And slowly but surely, he got all the books on schedule and on time. And then, of course, once that happened, then he had time to really look at what everybody was doing and, you know, nitpick us to death, you know, because he wanted everything to be, you know, to be perfect. And, of course, what's that thing? Perfection is the enemy of something. Production, maybe? Because it's hard to make anything perfect. But if you try too hard to make everything perfect, you never get anything done. So I think Jack Kirby once said, somebody asked him how he figured out what to do with the anatomy of when he was drawing because he was so fast. And he said, if I had to stop and figure out the anatomy, I'd never get these pages done. And, you know, it's true. Kirby, you know, he didn't draw realistic anatomy, but he knew what he was conveying. He was a good storyteller. And, you know, real anatomy could never do the kind of tricks that Kirby put his figures through, so just as well. So, you know, that's what happened. That's how I got back over to Marvel, and I accepted the editorial position. I did that for about another 5 years, maybe 6 years. But even after I left staff, I'd introduced Marvel Fanfare, and I kept that for a while until the end of its run, actually. It ran exactly 10 years. It was a bi-monthly, so 60 issues. And I did it till the bitter end. And the thing about Fanfare that, I'm not sure where I am on your question. you wanted to know how I became editor at DC and how I went back to being an editor at Marvel? Was that basically it?
I mean, essentially, yes. You've walked us through. Actually, I'm just looking at our time, and we're at an hour right now, so I almost think that we can end it off with, like, final thoughts on Marvel Fanfare, like you were just starting to do, and then maybe we can have you come back at some point to kind of go from the 80s forward.
Well, yeah, two things that I did. Again, this was to my benefit. When I became an editor at Marvel, I started doing, at one point they offered me, I can't remember, either the X-Men books or the Spider-Man books, the whole line of those books. And I just couldn't imagine anything more boring than doing nothing but X-Men or nothing but Spider-Man. I like the variety. So I don't remember. I was doing Doctor Strange, and I was doing the Defenders, and I might have been doing one of the Spider-Man books still. I don't recall. But at some point, you know, I was editing my line of books with the help of an assistant editor, and we had a couple reprint titles and a few other things going on. I remember one time there was a picture of me in my office at Marvel, and there were like 14 covers on the wall behind me, printed issues. And I'm saying, did I really edit all of those books? And, you know, the answer is no. I did have an assistant editor. You know, initially it was Joe Duffy. Mm. But, you know, but there was a stream, Mary, oh no, I'm blanking on her name. Mary, no, not Mary. Well, Mary McCormick, I think it might have been, but Ann Nesenti was my an assistant, and there were a string of other guys, including Jack Abel at one point. He had had a stroke and couldn't ink or draw for the time being, so he became my assistant editor, and later became a proofreader at Marvel because he was a wonderful nitpicker on that kind of stuff and very good. Anyway, but one of the things I did, I had been doing lots of covers for Marvel. This is when I really was doing a lot of covers in the late 70s through the early 80s. And one day Larry Hama strolled into my office and said, you know, Al, you shouldn't be drawing your own covers for the books I was editing. So the Hulk and the Defenders and, you name it, whatever, ROM. I did a lot of ROM covers. You know, but a whole bunch of different stuff. And, you know, I said, well, why is that, Larry? He says, well, you know, it's a conflict of interest. And I said, well, I guess I can see what you're saying, but, you know, Marvel likes me as a cover artist, and they use me. So if I'm editing all these titles, doesn't it make sense that I'd want to use a guy that Marvel likes to use on covers? I mean, in other words, me. And he said, yeah, but, you know, you're not objective, and if you do a bad cover, you don't tell yourself it's bad. You just do it anyway. And I said, Larry, are you implying I ever do a bad cover? And he said, you know what I'm saying. I said, yeah, I do. So I popped down to Shooter's office. I said, Jim, Larry Hama raises an interesting issue. He says, what's that, Al? And I said, I told him what Larry had said. And he says, well, Al, we think you're doing great covers for us. We're very happy to have you doing covers for us. But I'll tell you what, just to allay Larry's concerns, how about if I will be your de facto editor for the covers that you do, you know, for your own titles? You know, bring me the cover sketch. I'll approve it or not. And then you go ahead and do the cover. And it's all, you know, above board and kosher and hunky-dory. And I said, great. And as a result, I did tons of covers. Many for myself, but many for other people as well, and also, you know, for the books I was drawing, like the Avengers and Peter Parker, and some of the other ones, and in fact, I think I did strings of covers on both those titles and Kitty Pryde Wolverine, by the way, where I think I did really, really, really good covers. I mean, much better than my work normally was. I was an okay cartoonist. A very, you know, very solid storyteller, but not an inspired artist. You know, not a brilliant draftsman or you know, a brilliant creator like Kirby or somebody like that. But I could raise my game for a single illustration, like a cover. And I think the string of covers I did on Peter Parker, once I was drawing the title, I think were very, very good. And also, here's a pet peeve. I found out that on the direct sales copies, you could eliminate the UPC box, you know, that little stripy box, you know, for the universal pricing code that they could scan at the drugstores or comic shops. But a direct sales, of course, they eliminated that, and they instead they put like a little head of Spider-Man on in that box. But I found out that if the area behind that box was either all black or all white, they could eliminate it completely from the direct sales copies. And I said, well, that thing's an eyesore in either case, whether it's got Spider-Man in it or not, because it takes you, you know, away from the flow of the cover. So I designed a very great number of covers. I mean, not a huge amount, but a decent amount, where the area behind there was either all black or all white. And I would put a note, please remove UPC box from direct sales, you know, plates. And they would follow my instructions maybe half the time. So that's very, to this day, obviously, this is what, 30, 40 years later. Mm-hmm. It still just gets in my craw, you know, because there were covers that I designed where that thing could have been eliminated, where they left it in there anyway. So it's very frustrating. And the ones where they did take it out, it looks much better, and I'm proud of that. And you know, I used to make use of the, you know, of that little bits of knowledge to make better looking covers. Some of the color hole type things I did, like there's one cover I drew with Captain America behind bars.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an all blue cover, and the blue of the background bleeds into the blue of his uniform. And there's no like holding lines on him. There are on the he's you know holding the bars of the cell, and there's a window tilted at a, you know, at a 45 degree angle, just basically to indicate that he's in prison. And it's a design element, because if it was really behind him, it would have been, you know, it would have been square up and down, rectilinear, the same way, you know, the bars were straight up and down. But I thought that tilt actually sort of helped make the cover. And, you know, that's a cover where the blue bleeding into the blue made it very striking looking. And that came from having a conversation with Jim Steranko one time, which I'm sure he doesn't remember, but it made an impression on me. And he was talking about how to use color holds, and he had experience in a printing or advertising you know, business. Mm-hmm. And so he knew how to use the printing process to enhance, you know, he did a lot of interesting things with some of his covers. And I did stuff like that with some of mine and some of the Spider-Man covers, both the ones with his regular old costume or the new black costume, where if you made the costume solid black and you had him like coming out of a black background, you know, it was very striking and very dramatic and graphic. And those were inspired by an early Steve Ditko Spider-Man cover. I think it was with the Molten Man, one of the first probably 10 issues.
Okay.
And he did Spider-Man, the blue part of his costume as black and coming out of the shadows. And it was very effective and very interesting, and it caught my eye. And then later I found out about an illustrator from the early part of the 20th century, the, you know, 1920s or whatever, whenever, you know, the age of illustration there. His name was Coles Phillips. And he had something he was famous for, magazine covers, called the Fadeaway Girls. And he would do the same thing where the women would be wearing dresses or outfits, and the shape of their figures would be defined by either things in the foreground or the background, but the background color would blend in. It would be the same color as the dress itself.
Mm.
So it's an interesting optical illusion and very eye-catching. And I stole whatever interesting things I could to do a lot of those covers. So to wrap up, I did create fanfare because Shooter explained that we weren't making money on our advertising. I said, what? And he says, you know, we get paid for the advertising pages, but more importantly, that's, you know, the books are 32 pages, and then the four covers. And he says, there's advertising on three of the covers, and on about seven or eight of the interior pages, there's 22 pages of editorial, and then there might be a house ad or a bullpen page or a letters page. So, you know, all the other pages with ads, he said, we don't have to pay editorial costs for those. So we're getting some money from the advertisers, and we're not having to pay a writer, a penciler, an inker, a letterer, a colorist, blah, blah. And, you know, mostly those things were all printed up for the entire line and then inserted in the various comics. They, you know, the advertising pages would appear on the same pages on every book Marvel published in a given month. Mm. So they could print those all in one fell swoop and then just insert them in the other, you know, in the other books, all the other books. So I said, and this is when the direct sales market was starting to take off, and we were beginning to see the potential there. If we charge a smaller wholesale rate, and the dealers, the direct sales dealers, would not return issues for credit. They couldn't. They weren't allowed. That was part of the deal. But they'd get a steeper discount, and they would keep all their extra unsold copies, which they could then use for back issues and probably hike up the price and make more money that way. Hmm. And so I said, well, tell me, Jim, what kind of format would it take if I wanted to do a comic that was all editorial material, all art and stories, no ads, and let's say better quality paper stock and better quality coloring and printing, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I said, how much would we have to charge to make a profit? Well, you know, the answer is usually, well, it depends how many you sell. But he went, you know, he took the premise and he went up to, you know, I don't know who. Whether he went to the direct sales people or if he, I'm sure he had to go to the, you know, the treasury people, mm-hmm. and say, look, what do we need to charge cover price for a book with no ads? How, you know, what will balance out the lack of ads and the extra cost of all that editorial material? And they came up with a figure, which I think, as I recall, was $1.50, maybe. The first fanfare sold for $1.50. And I don't know what comics were selling for at the time, probably 75 mm-hmm. cents. So it's double the price, but you get a lot, you know, more bang for your buck as far as I was concerned. And he came back and he told me this. And then I said, oh, okay, good to know. And then, you know, like a week later, he popped his head and he says, so Al, when, you know, when's that first issue of Fanfare coming out? And I went, what? So I scrambled around and I started putting it together. I actually had Ed Hannigan design the logo. And I thought, you know, it was a clever title, you know, Marvel Fanfare, because it's fair that the fans would appreciate. And, you know, and then Jim said, well, you're going to have to. I said, I know we're not doing the ads, but, you know, you need an editorial page in there. And I just, the idea of having to type, you know, an entire page's worth of typed copy, I don't know how many written pages that would have been on a, you know, but two, three, and I just didn't want, I was, you know, I'm more an artist than a writer, obviously. And I said, no, I said, listen, how about I do it as a strip? Could I do a strip? He said, sure. He said, and I said, could I get paid for doing it in the, you know, over and above my editorial? You know, I was on staff at the time, so it was included in my, you know, editorial fee, just doing the book. He says, yeah, I don't see why not. So, you know, and then I went and I thought about it, and I'm like Murphy Anderson before me, I'm an inveterate punster, and I came up with editory-al, editorial. And, you know, and I did that first one. I think I did a 9-panel grid because I don't think I was even aware of Harvey Kurtzman at the time, or at least wasn't aware of, like, he had that script in the old days, Hey Look. Mm-hmm. But people said, oh, you're doing Kurtzman, huh? And it doesn't look anything like Kurtzman, actually, of course. But because of the grid, you know, I mean, you could just as easily have said, you're doing Steve Ditko, huh? And I would have probably said closer to that, yeah. But I came up with the editorials, and after a while, even those seemed like too much work, but I did them. And they were simple and fast, but they always ended up being the last thing in every issue to get done. I was the worst. So, that's, you know, but that's what happened, and it became a thing, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, they recognize it. It helped actually cement my persona in the Marvel universe. I'm, oh, it's editorial. Although a lot of people would come up and they'd want me to sign, you know, Epic Comics, where Archie would do a caricature of himself. Mm. And I said, no, no, can't you see? This character has hair. I have no hair. And they say, that's not you? I said, no, that's Archie Goodwin. You know, he's a much better looking guy than me. So they'd say, oh, I'm sorry. But and now since that, I've had, I've done introductions to hardcover reprints where they ask me to do an intro, and I say, can I do an editorial instead? And, you know, sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. And I, you know, I'm having T-shirts printed up, which are going to, when I go to shows, I'm going to read, they're going to say convention-al, conventional. Yeah, my name lends itself to a number of puns. I did a bunch of reviews of independent comics for a publisher a few years back, and I drew a number of my own persona, but in this case, I was Critic-al. Thank you. And I guess you could say I'm Comic-al. And also, I thought I might have to get a T-shirt printed up for when I'm, you know, after the show, and I'm no longer Convention-al, but I'm Unconvention-al. So I'm going to have a whole little cottage industry there.
Sounds great. Well, again, thank you so much, Al, for taking the time to, you know, talk with us about, you know, as you said, kind of getting into the industry, becoming an inker, what it was like at that period. I'm always curious, you know, to hear behind the scenes things about how, you know, what things are really going on. So thank you so much for illuminating me. And I will have to have you back at some point in the not too distant future to kind of chart the 80s forward, because we're in the early 80s now. So we'll have to have you come back to the fill in the blanks.
All right. Well, I'm glad I could be illuminating, if not illustrating.
Thank you so much, Al.
All right. You take care.